Welcome to Base by Base.
Great to be here.
Today we're going to tackle something that's, well, a really persistent challenge in human genetics. We're talking about understanding missense variants.
Yes. Those single-letter typos in the DNA that swap one amino acid for another in a protein sequence.
Exactly. And the tricky part is they're the most common type of protein-altering change we find, but figuring out what they actually do, that's tough.
It really is, because the effect can vary so much. You know, some might do absolutely nothing. Others might tweak the protein's activity a little, maybe make it work better or worse. Some could completely break it or change how it interacts with other things.
And all that uncertainty leads to this huge logjam in clinical genetics. Anyone who's seen a genetic test report has probably encountered the term variant of uncertain significance, a VUS.
Oh, definitely. The sources we looked at point out just how big this problem is. Over half, I think, of the missense variants listed in big databases like ClinVar are currently stuck in that VUS category.
Over half. That's a lot of question marks.
It's a massive gap in our understanding. It's not like, say, a nonsense variant that just chops the protein short, or a frame shift that scrambles a whole code downstream. Those are usually pretty clear cut, functionally speaking.
Right. But a missense variant, it's subtle.
It is. Its impact depends on, well, partly the chemical difference between the amino acids, sure, but also hugely on where that change happens. Is it in a critical spot like the enzyme's active site, or a place that needs modification later?
And it's not just about the linear sequence, the chain of amino acids. The 3D shape is vital, isn't it?
Absolutely critical. Is that changed amino acid buried deep inside the protein core, or is it sitting out on the surface? How close is it in folded 3D space to other important functional parts, or maybe where another protein needs to bind?
These things are hard to guess just from the sequence. We have prediction tools, right? Like VEPs, CADI scores, things like that.
We do. And they're powerful for giving a general probability of how damaging a variant might be genome-wide. But pinning down the precise effect, the pathogenicity of one specific missense change, that's still really challenging. We definitely need other approaches to complement the genomics.
Which brings us to the study we're looking at today. It takes a really novel angle, using work from Maria F. Palafox and her colleagues. This was published in the American Journal of Human Genetics back in 2025. They used mass spectrometry-based chemoproteomics.
Right, chemoproteomics. It's a fascinating technique. Basically, you use these small chemical probes that are designed to react with specific amino acids, but only when those amino acids are accessible and reactive within the protein's natural environment, like inside a cell.
So it's like sending in little chemical spies to see which parts of the protein are chemically active or available.
Kind of, yeah. By seeing which amino acids get tagged by these probes, you get a map of potentially functional sites. This particular study zeroed in on cysteine, lysine, and tyrosine residues. They grouped these together and called them chemoproteomic detected amino acids. Or CPDAAs for short.
Okay, CPDAAs. So the big question they were asking was, can measuring the reactivity of these specific amino acids at the protein level help us identify clinically important variants and maybe pinpoint functionally crucial regions within genes known to cause single gene or monogenic diseases?
That was the core idea. Can this protein chemistry information shed light on genetic variation?
So how did they set it up? What was the method?
Well, first they had to gather the data. They collected and standardized a bunch of existing published chemoproteomics data sets that specifically measured the reactivity of cysteine, lysine, and tyrosine across many different proteins.
Okay, so they built this database of reactive sites. Mm-hmm. How did they link that protein level information back to genes and diseases?
Good question. They took the proteins where they had detected these reactive sites, the CPD proteins, and they checked them against known lists of important genes. Specifically, they looked for overlap with genes known to cause monogenic disorders using the Omium database, that's sort of the master catalog, and they also checked against genes that are known targets for FDA-approved drugs.
Right, so focusing on genes with clear clinical relevance already, what about the variants themselves? Where did they get that data?
They pulled missense variant data from ClinVar, and they categorized them based on the ClinVar classification, pathogenic, benign, or those tricky VUSs.
Okay.
And as sort of baseline or control, they also used common variants found in the general population from databases like NOMA&D, the idea being these are likely tolerated changes.
So now they have pieces. reactive protein sites, CPDAAs, disease genes, drug target genes, and different classes of variants, pathogenic, benign, VUS, common. How did they put it all together? How did they analyze the relationship?
They looked at proximity, basically. How close are the variants to these reactive CPDAA sites? And they did this in two main ways.
Yeah.
First, the simple way, just along the linear protein sequence. Like, if you have variant at position 100, is there a detected CPDAA site at position 98 or 101? They use sort of a sliding window approach, looking about six amino acids upstream or downstream.
Makes sense. And the second way, I guess the 3D structure.
Exactly, the more biologically realistic view. They mapped both the variant positions and the detected CPDAA site positions onto known 3D protein structures from the protein data bank, the PDB.
Right.
Then they calculated the actual physical distance in 3D space between atoms in the CPDAA residue, like the sulfur and cysteine or the nitrogen and lysine, and atoms in the variant residue or nearby residues. They mostly used a cutoff of 8 angstroms.
8 angstroms? Why that distance?
It's a pretty standard cutoff in structural biology. It's generally considered close enough for amino acids to potentially interact or influence each other directly.
Got it. So they're asking, are the bad variants, the pathogenic ones, more likely to be right at a reactive site or maybe just physically close to one in the folded protein compared to benign or common variants?
That's the core question. And to quantify it, they use statistical tests like Fisher's exact test and calculated odds ratios. This tells you, you know, how much more likely pathogenic variants are to be found at or near CPDAA sites compared to other sites or other types of variants.
And they also brought in the CADI scores.
Yes, they layered that in too. They mapped the CPDA sites to the CADI pathogenicity prediction scores using another database called DBNSFP. This let them see if the sites flagged by their protein chemistry method also tended to be regions that genomic predictors thought were likely to be functionally important or deleterious.
It sounds like a really comprehensive approach, combining the genetics, the protein chemistry, the 3D structure, trying to get a fuller picture.
It really is. It's a multi-omic strategy aimed right at this very specific, very important problem of variant interpretation.
Okay, so let's get into the results. What do they find? Starting at the gene level, the bigger picture. Were these CPD proteins, the ones with the detected reactive sites, anything special?
Oh yeah, definitely. The gene level findings were quite strong, actually. They had data covering reactive sites on about 4,500 proteins, and they found that these CPD proteins were significantly enriched for genes already known to cause monogenic disorders listed in OMIM.
Enriched? How much?
About 31% of all the genes in OMIM were identified as CPD proteins in their datasets.
Wow, nearly a third. That's a lot. It suggests the method is definitely picking up on functionally important players.
It really does. And they were also significantly enriched for genes that are targets of FDA-approved drugs, which, again, points towards these proteins being functionally critical and clinically relevant.
Okay, that makes sense. Did they look at how much variation these CPD genes tolerate in the general population, like evolutionary constraint?
Yes, and this was a really interesting result. These CPD genes are significantly more constrained against missense variation, meaning they tend to have fewer missense variants floating around in healthy populations compared to other genes. They're less tolerant of change.
So evolution is selecting against changes in these proteins.
Seems like it. And the effect was strongest for proteins where they detected all three types of reactive amino acids, cysteine, lysine, and tyrosine. Those showed the highest intolerance, the highest constraint, with an odds ratio close to 7, which is a very strong signal.
And an OR of almost 7. That's huge. It suggests these proteins are under really strong pressure to stay the same, presumably because their function is so vital.
Exactly. And this enrichment for constraint among CPD genes was even stronger than for the overall set of OMIM genes, which are already known to be pretty constrained. They also found CPD proteins tend to be involved in more protein-protein interactions. It all fits together. These are important, connected, functionally constrained proteins.
Okay, so the method clearly flags important genes, but the ultimate goal is variant interpretation, right? Can it pinpoint critical spots within those proteins? What did they find at the amino acid level?
Right, that's the crucial next step. They focused in on the set of genes that were both in OMIM and detected as CPD proteins, about 926 of them. And here they asked, are the specific CPDAA sites, the actual detected CCLIs and TIR residues, more likely to be the site of a pathogenic missense variant compared to other CCLIs or TIR residues in the same proteins that weren't detected as reactive?
And were they?
Overall, yes. The detected CPDAA sites showed a significant enrichment for pathogenic missense variants hitting right at that site. the odds ratio is about 1.54.
Okay, so a pathogenic variant is about 1.5 times more likely to land exactly on a detected reactive site compared to a non-detected one of the same type. That seems, well, it's significant, but maybe not overwhelmingly high.
It shows the signals there, but yeah, it gets more interesting when you break it down. For detected lysine and detected tyrosine sites, the enrichment for pathogenic variants was stronger. Both had an odds ratio of about 2.56.
Okay, 2.5 times more likely. That's more compelling. What about cysteine?
That was the surprise. For detected cysteine sites, the trend was positive, but it didn't reach statistical significance. The OR was around 1.34.
Huh. That is surprising. Cysteines are often involved in really key things like disulfide bonds, holding proteins together, or in enzyme active sites. You'd think they'd be hotspots for pathogenic mutations. Any idea why the signal is weaker there?
The authors dug into this, and it's quite insightful. They found something interesting. OMUM disease genes, as a group, actually have significantly fewer cysteine residues overall compared to non-OMUM genes.
Really? Fewer cysteines and disease genes?
Yeah, which is intriguing on its own. But also, remember how the chemoproteomics works? It detects reactive sites? Those cysteines locked up in stable disulfide bonds. They might not be very reactive or accessible to the chemical probes under the conditions used. So the method might be systematically missing some of the most structurally critical cysteines.
Ah, I see. So the detected cysteines might be a specific subset, perhaps not the ones most crucial for, say, overall folding, even if they are reactive in other ways.
Potentially, yes. That could definitely explain why the overlap with pathogenic variants was less striking for detected cysteines compared to detected lysines and tyrosines in this analysis. It's a limitation of the current detection methods, perhaps.
That makes sense. Did they look at what kinds of amino acid changes were common at pathogenic sites in these genes?
They did. And it matched previous studies pretty well. Changes like glycine to arginine or leucine to proline, these are known troublemakers, often disrupting structure. Yeah. They also saw that losing a cysteine, like a cyst changing to TIR or ARG, was common at pathogenic sites. Interestingly, mutations that create a new cysteine seem to be less common among pathogenic variants. Cysteine's role is clearly complex.
Okay, so detected sites themselves carry a signal, especially for lysine TIR. But you mentioned proximity analysis. What about variants that are near these detected sites, but not right on them?
Yes, and this is where I think the approach becomes particularly powerful for interpretation. First, looking just along the linear sequence in that 6 amino acid window around the detected CPDAs.
Uh-huh.
They found pathogenic missense variants were significantly enriched in these nearby windows too. Even if the variant wasn't the CPDA itself, if it was close by linearly, it was more likely to be pathogenic. The odds ratios were pretty solid. Around 2.1 for lysine windows, 2.2 for tyrosine, and 1.7 for cysteine windows.
So being near a detected reactive site along the chain makes a variant roughly twice as likely to be pathogenic.
Essentially, yes. And they showed pathogenic variants were physically closer on average to CPDAAs than benign or common variants were. It suggests the functional importance radiates out a bit from the detected site itself.
And what about the VUSs, those variants of uncertain significance? Where did they fall in this linear proximity analysis?
This was really interesting. VUSs were actually found quite frequently in these 6 amino acid windows around the detected CPDAAs. Nearly half of the windows they looked at contained at least one VUS.
Wow, almost half. So just knowing a VUS is linearly close to a detected reactive site could be a really useful clue, a way to flag it for more attention.
Exactly. It provides a data-driven way to prioritize which VUSs might be worth investigating further, because they're sitting in potentially functional neighborhoods.
Okay, that's the linear view. What about the 3D structure? Did being physically close in the folded protein give an even stronger signal?
Yes. Looking in 3D space within that 8 angstrom radius, they again found detected CPDA sites were significantly enriched for having pathogenic variants nearby compared to benign or common variants.
And did the different amino acid types behave differently in 3D proximity?
They did, and it was a bit different from the 1D picture. In 3D, the environments around detected cysteines and detected tyrosines seemed to harbor more proximal pathogenic variants than the environments around detected lysines.
So while the lysine site itself had a strong signal for direct hits, the 3D neighborhood around cysts and TIR seems more sensitive to nearby pathogenic changes.
That's what the data suggests, yeah.
Yeah.
It might reflect different functional roles or structural constraints around those residue types in 3D.
And VUSs, were they also enriched in the 3D neighborhoods?
Yes, significantly. And this was especially true for the detected cysteine environments in 3D. They found the CPDDC's neighborhoods were uniquely enriched for having both background missense variants and VUSs nearby. It was quite striking. Something like 58% of the detected cysteine 3D environments had at least one VUS within 8 angstroms.
58%. So a detected cysteine in 3D is often sitting in a cloud of VUSs. That seems like a really strong indicator that those VUSs might be functionally relevant.
It certainly points that way. And it ties in neatly with the CAD scores. They showed that CPDDA sites that had a lot of these proximal VUSs in 3D were also more likely to have high average CAD scores, often above that common pathogenicity prediction threshold of 25.
So you get multiple lines of evidence converging. The site is detected by chemoproteomics. It's got VUSs clustered nearby in 3D. And those VUSs often have high genomic predictor scores. That feels like a much stronger case for potential pathogenicity.
Absolutely. It's building a case with orthogonal data. They highlighted examples like a specific lysine in the MSH6 protein involved in DNA repair, which had like 59 VUSs nearby in 3D.
Sure.
And another lysine in MSH2. These look like really important functional hotspots.
And they didn't just rely on correlations. They did a deep dive into one specific protein, right? Fumarate hydratase.
Yes, FH. It's a great case study. It's a well-known enzyme in the Krebs cycle, and mutations cause severe inherited disorders, including certain cancers. So it's clinically very relevant, well-studied, has a known structure, and lots of known variants, including VUSs.
How did the chemoproteomics data map onto FH?
They found 16 detected CPDDA sites in FH. And when they looked at where known pathogenic variants in VUSs were located in the 3D structure relative to these 16 sites, a couple of specific cysteines, C333 and C434, really stood out. They had a high number of pathogenic variants and VUSs clustered around them in 3D space.
Okay, so the pattern held up, but did they test it experimentally?
Yes, and this is crucial. They actually made two specific FH variants that changed those detected cysteines, C333 to tyrosine and C434 to arginine. They then tested how these variants affected the protein's function. Fumarate hydratase normally works as a tetramer, four units coming together. Their experiments show that these variants, located right at the detected CPDDA sites, messed that up. The protein couldn't form the proper tetramer as well, and instead tended to form smaller, likely less functional dimers.
So direct experimental proof. The reactive site detected by chemoproteomics was indeed critical, and mutating it caused a functional defect linked to the disease mechanism.
Exactly. It really validates the whole approach, connecting the chemical detection to the genetic variant to the actual protein malfunction. A really nice piece of work.
Okay, so stepping back and looking at all these results, the gene level enrichment, the site level, the proximity in 1D and 3D, the FH case study, what are the big takeaways here? What are the implications?
I think the main message is that combining this chemoproteomic reactivity data with genetic variant information is a really valuable strategy. It gives us a new way to flag potentially functional missense variants and highlight important regions within proteins that we might have missed otherwise.
And how could that be used, practically speaking?
Well, the most obvious application is in variant interpretation, especially for that huge mountain of VUSs. If you see a VUS that sits right on, or very close to, one of these detected CPDDA sites, that provides strong independent evidence suggesting it might actually be functionally relevant. It helps prioritize which VUSs to focus on for more functional testing, or maybe even helps push them towards reclassification over time.
So it could help clear up some of that uncertainty in genetic reports?
Potentially, yes. Speed up diagnoses. And then there's the drug development angle.
How so?
Because these detected CPDDA sites are, by definition, chemically reactive and accessible. That makes them potentially great targets for drugs, particularly covalent inhibitors drugs that form a permanent bond with the protein.
Ah, because the site is already primed to react chemically.
Exactly. So identifying these sites in disease-causing proteins, especially maybe in rare disease proteins where options are limited, could open up new avenues for designing targeted therapies. The study noted about a third of rare disorder proteins seem to have these detectable sites. That's a lot of potential targets.
Could it also help with genes that are just tricky to analyze using other methods?
Yes, that's another good point. Some genes are really small, or they have lots of similar-looking copies in the genome, which makes population genetic analyses like constraint metrics harder to interpret reliably. Adding this layer of protein chemical reactivity data could provide crucial orthogonal evidence about functional importance in those cases.
It definitely sounds like a powerful addition to the toolkit, but no method is perfect. What are the limitations we should keep in mind?
The authors were upfront about this. Firstly, the current chemoproteomic datasets, while growing, don't capture every possible reactive cis, alias, or tear in every protein. There's still incomplete coverage. So you could have a functionally important site that just hasn't been detected yet by these methods.
Right. Absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence.
Precisely. And the variant databases themselves, like ClinVar, have limitations. It's a fantastic resource.
Yeah.
But interpretations can vary between labs and classifications can change. Using more deeply curated data sets like ClinIn could help, but those don't cover everything either.
And it's not meant to replace other functional assays entirely.
No, it's seen as complementary. It's not really set up for screening thousands of variants at once, like, say, a deep mutational scan can.
Yeah.
Because of the coverage issue, you might get false negatives. A variant could be pathogenic, but not be near a detected site. But the flip side is, a positive result finding a variant at or near a detected CPDA provides pretty strong supporting evidence for functional impact.
And the findings are mainly focused on a specific set of genes.
Yes, they focused on known monogenic disease genes from OMIM. So while the principles likely apply more broadly, we need to be cautious about directly extrapolating these specific enrichment numbers or conclusions to all human proteins or all types of genetic variation.
So where does this field go next? What are the future directions?
Well, the logical next step is to integrate this chemoproteomic approach more tightly with high-throughput functional genomics. Imagine combining the CPDAA maps with results from CRISPR editing screens that systematically test variant effects, or with deep mutational scanning experiments. That could give us a much more detailed, large-scale understanding of exactly how CPDAA reactivity relates to the precise functional consequences and severity of different missense variants.
It really underscores how combining these different layers of biological information, the genome sequence, the protein's chemical state, its structure, its function, is so powerful.
It absolutely is. You get a much richer, more nuanced understanding than any single data type can provide alone. It shows we really need to look beyond just the DNA sequence to understand the molecular basis of health and disease.
So as a final thought for our listeners, what really stands out to you about this synergy? How does seeing detailed protein chemistry data layered onto large-scale genetic information change the way we might think about tackling disease or finding new treatments? Think about how these different views reinforce each other.
For me, it's that reinforcement, exactly. The genetics points you to potentially important genes or variants, and the proteomics can then highlight specific chemically active sites within those proteins that might be functionally critical or druggable. Neither tells the whole story alone. But together, they provide much stronger leads for understanding mechanisms and intervening therapeutically, especially for those challenging VUSs and rare diseases.
A really powerful combination. This discussion was based on an open access article published under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find the DOI and a link to the license itself in the description.